Hello all, welcome to the God Said Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press that publishes socially engaged fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And today, the podcast is hopefully kind of special and a little bit different. Normally, to any of our listeners, you know that I get together with Hans and Chris, who are the other editors of the press, and we talk about some novel, usually novel, that we've read. But today, we read a collection of short stories for the podcast, but we also actually have the author of that collection on the podcast as well. So our special guest is author Daryl Farmer. We're going to talk about his short story collection, Where We Land. Daryl is a faculty member at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he was actually on my master's thesis committee. He was the lead committee member, and he didn't deny me my master's degree, so that's why we're here. You know, if he had denied me my master's degree, then there would be, you know, bitter hatred forever and ever. But there isn't. So I kind of envision this podcast slightly differently, you know, because Daryl is here, but also I thought we would have more of a craft focus, since we'd be able to ask Daryl, directly about the ideas and whatnot that went into writing Where We Land. And the first big question that I have on my mind for you, Daryl, is when were you always envisioning this book as a single unified collection, or did you just write the stories separately, not thinking of them as a larger whole?
Oh, great question. Thanks for having me on, by the way. It's good to hear from all three of you guys. Some of the Alaska stories in this collection came out of my master's program at the University of Nebraska. And at that time I had conceived a collection of Alaska short stories. So, with those particular four stories, I kind of imagined them together, but I would say the other stories were, largely random other publications that I've had. And they kind of all came together. So there was a mix. The answer to your questions, it's a mix of both of those things. I really wasn't, I didn't really conceive of putting all of these stories together until I actually talked to the publisher about doing a book together. And then that's what kind of pushed me to put it all together. So.
Did you find when the conversations with the publisher did kind of lead you to think about compiling these as one book, did you start to find connections or resonances between them that you hadn't before? Because it seems to me like in a lot of ways, like thematically, the tone, the themes, the settings, there is a lot of it's a fairly cohesive work, right? And I don't know how much of that you kind of discovered by happy accident as you were thinking about compiling them, how did looking at what had been sort of a disconnected group of stories change your perspective on those stories?
I don't know that I honestly really started thinking about things thematically until I started putting them together and try to come to some kind of order to put the stories in. So I don't know. The stories feel a little random to me. I feel this way, and I talk to my students about this, and I'm not sure everybody agrees with this, but I feel like when I read somebody's first collection of short stories, I don't want to read a lot of stories that feel the same to me. I want to see kind of a range, because I'm trying to kind of gauge what the author's range is. So I think that maybe I was actually working against, I wasn't working against anything thematically, you know, but I was trying to produce kind of a range of stories. There's a couple of stories in there that are a little bit experimental. No, so I was thinking more about how to kind of demonstrate a range in my writing than I was thematically. On the other hand, you don't, you know, it's like making an album. You don't want to do a folk song and then jump into a hip hop song too quickly. You know, you have to be careful that there's the tonality kind of is consistent throughout. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know what I mean.
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
You get me.
That's super interesting that you say that, Daryl, because, you know, I agree with Hans. I think this is a very cohesive work, and it seems to me that, like, most of the stories kind of revolve around age, death, and manhood, if that makes sense. Those seem to be recurrent ideas or recurrent subjects that the stories deal with. And I definitely see the range. There were the two stories specifically stuck out to me. The Chris, you said the one about the frat kid in college is called Hurdles. And then the other one that is it's like 4 or 5 pages about an old guy who has...
The one that's like all one sentence almost?
Yeah, the one that's all one sentence. Is that Flight? No, it's Anniversary.
Yeah,
Anniversary. So I definitely see some formal range in that sense. I don't know if I have a question other than... just kind of commenting and drawing out the
I kind ideas. Of have a question that might come from that. Because Jack London actually comes up in the book.
Oh, definitely.
And I was thinking about style, maybe not so much thematic cohesiveness, but sort of when you're writing about, and not all of these stories are about people in harsher, more remote locations, but it is kind of something that recurs. And I was wondering, I was trying to kind of think of like how I would describe sort of like if I were writing like the back of a book about like man's relationship with nature in Alaska and Colorado, and it would be like Spare, you know, but I didn't think of this as like a Spare novel, in part because of Hurdles and Anniversary and other parts that felt like that they were, you know, not trying to sort of like follow actions in a very like indifferent environment, but like really delving into like emotional depth and of the characters and memory. And one of the things you mentioned, like men and death and I would add, like, a lot of these stories seem to be about, like, transitional, like, people, like, traveling or, like, moving from one place to another physically. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that physical relocation sort of, like, mirroring an emotional transition as well. But I was wondering, like, given the overt on the back Jack London reference and Jack London coming up within it, like, how would you – do you think of – there is, like, a – do you think that there is a kind of a style that like you put on or that you like think about even unconsciously or unconsciously, or that you think about when you're writing about people in nature? And I, you know, maybe it's easier to talk about a specific story, and I'm thinking of the story. Is it On the Old Denali Road where he's trying to get to the cabin?
Yeah.
That's the version. That's like a to build a fire type story.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And
right.
Is there is there a style for writing about, you know, people being alone in nature or people finding themselves in nature, or is that something that like when we open a book that has stories about that we just sort of like project onto the piece, you know? I don't know if that question totally.
Yeah,
makes
totally.
Sense.
There's such an evolution from like Jack London to writers that are considered environmental or place-based writers now. That's I hadn't read To Build a Fire until after I wrote that story, but I had read...
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's but I amazing. Had read a Jack London that, story, that which is called Love of Life, which is a very similar story. Actually, I think a better story, but that's kind of my contrarian. I tend to think of things as more obscure as being better than the things we know more.
Oh,
but
yeah,
it's very much about
are.
A guy kind of surviving outdoors. For me, the key thing that you said is you know, this gets into kind of the whole political kind of thematic, maybe, but the idea of rugged individualism and man versus nature, conquering nature, and to a large extent, I kind of want to work against that. I think if you ever read Arctic Dreams by Barry Lopez, he talks about how... some of those Arctic explorers went up there and their first thing was to kind of try to build communities where the native communities in the winter, they kind of spread out because the resources were so scarce. And of course the European kind of people coming in thought that was not, they use the word primitive maybe or something like that. But the truth is these are people that actually know how to live in this environment in
right,
this
right,
way.
Right.
So a large extent with that story, I think it was very much, and London was a writer who, especially those kinds of stories were kind of men, almost always men surviving in nature, you know, by themselves as an individual. But for me, with that story on the old Denali Road, it was part of that is the character coming to a realization about his own kind of fallibility and vulnerability in that situation, but there's also more hopefully emotional depth as part of that, you know, where ultimately he's imagining the family who got in a similar situation and they all ended up dying, you know, and his thoughts were more with his family back home, you know, so hopefully I'm working against that kind of rugged individualism.
That's super interesting. I really like that. Like, it's a dialogue with London, except, you know, you're kind of answering back in the opposite way. That's super interesting. I wish I thought about that on my own, like by myself, but I didn't, unfortunately.
I usually don't think about anything until I say it out loud.
Right. Sure. No.
Are you
absolutely?
Are you working against like that idea of finding yourself in nature at all? I mean, like, it's just something you said reminded me of the title story, Where We Land. And I felt my impression was that though the narrator is in a place and it really does, there is like, it does feel like movement is just really a part of these stories, like going from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And then at the end we have a narrator, a protagonist who's like in a place, but then I actually didn't think that he'd landed there, was my impression. Like, he sort of feels like he might have, but well, it ends with him. Well, we do a lot of spoilers in this podcast, but he's moving, he's kayaking, mm-hmm. again, he's moving.
Yeah.
And his relationships are unsettled. So I wondered about maybe some of the other things that he might be working against in this, to do with like nature writing and environmental writing.
And I'd like to add that story was also super interesting because I felt that there was a level of awareness that the reader had that the character didn't have. Did anybody else feel that? Did anybody else notice that? No.
Well, okay. I don't know that I would have characterized it that way exactly. When you say there's a level of awareness the reader had that the narrator didn't, what do you mean by that specifically?
Well, specifically, like, later in the story, early in the story, there's some sense that he's on a phone call with his mom, and his mom says his dad forgives him, but we don't know what for yet. And the character thinks it should be the other way around. But then when you get to the situation, it actually seems like the character acted pretty poorly. even if like the dad has been bad to him, like he erupted and shoved him and punched him in the face or something, like that kind of seemed to me that indicated that there's this level of awareness about his own actions that that he just didn't have. He didn't have a level of awareness, and it seemed like that was related to what you were saying, Chris, about how he hasn't landed yet. Like it's called Where We Land, but at the end it's like he's still moving, and maybe partly that's because he doesn't get who he is yet or understand himself. I don't know. Daryl, this is your
do you know Daryl?
I feel like yeah, I feel like the father's story is the one that's entirely unresolved, you know.
Mm.
And I think that is the thing he's running from in a way, and he's not really addressing really the thing that he most needs to address, which is back in Florida, which is about 4,000 miles away from where he's run to.
Okay,
so
sure.
I think there's definitely
so Patrick is vindicated.
Unsettling, yeah, element of that story.
Sure.
Yes, Patrick is vindicated.
That was the first suggested title for this podcast. Was Patrick is vindicated, and we very narrowly talked him out of it.
Although he finds a way to bring it up in every episode, I imagine, in one way or another.
No, I had to, you know, I tried to be humble. Like when Hans convinced me that Jane Austen is a shitty writer, I admitted that she was. Like he was like, she sucks, she's horrible, and she's not as good as you think, Patrick. And I was like, oh man, he's right.
Hans, I heard you chime in briefly. Did you have like a question?
Well, I mean, I don't. There's a few things I've been thinking about. I don't know necessarily that any of them follow super. I can't do like a super organic transition from where we are.
So it's
going to be sort of an abrupt shift. So if anybody has like a question that flows better, I would defer to them.
I might. I mean, my question was about endings in general.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe like starting from how do you navigate. I mean, are you kind of feeling out like what is appropriate for the character? Obviously, you're feeling out what's appropriate for the character, for the story. But do you feel like the urge to make something happy or sad? Like to resolve for a little bit the favor of these people that you're writing about? Or is it, are you kind of really trying to figure out what's appropriate?
Yeah, I don't. Like, I think it's more organic than that. I don't think that I think consciously about happy or sad, but something that just feels logical. I mean, ideally, you want something to be. There's a term I can't think of a person who first used this term, but an ending should be surprising, but also feel inevitable. I'm more interested in bringing the story to some kind of logical place of, if not resolution, then of reflection, or, you know, a reasonable logical stopping place. So happy and sad is not really. I think the emotional content of the story can't happen in the ending. If it does, then the story is probably a weak ending. You know, so I'm not so interested in that other than what happens with the character. I think in Where We Land is a good example, because I struggled with that ending a little bit. And that story was published in the Whitefish Review out of Montana, and Pam Houston was the guest editor, and she helped me a lot with that ending. That ending can't end happy. We've already established that the woman is not in love with him. So they can't end up together, you know, but they do have something, and they can be out on the water together, enjoying nature together, you know. Mm. And so it has to have an ending that's not entirely hopeless, but also that feels inevitable within the rest of the story itself. So I think that's the important thing with endings. I struggle with endings, though. The endings are the hardest things for me to write.
Could you expand on what you meant by the emotion of the story can't happen in the ending? Otherwise, it's a weak story. Or maybe I misheard you a little bit.
No, that's totally what I said without putting any thought into it. So now this is my opportunity.
You made your bed, now
you gotta lie. I think that the emotional content is kind of what's happened in the built up and the kind of rising action and arc of the story. And then if you have the trouble, you know, Shirley Jackson's The Lottery.
Mm-hmm. I read about 5 papers on that story every single semester that I teach.
I know, I do too. I do too. That's why I quit assigning.
I wish I didn't know it as well
that,
as I do.
Yeah.
I tried to, but
can't
then
end. Yeah. You know, it starts as a bright sunny day, but that story can't end with anything other than a stoning. Yeah, you know, it's kind of logical ending, but the emotional content is what's kind of built up throughout, where we have a community who's so tied to their traditions that they can't think through the reality of what they're doing, you know, and that's all set up through the end of the story. If you have a story where the ending doesn't match up, where you have a surprise endings, for example, which a lot of introductory students love, you know, or the infamous, and then he woke up and realized it was all a dream kind of story. If you have endings endings that don't jibe with the rest of the content of the story, just for the gimmick of being a surprise, and it just doesn't work. So.
But I'm really fascinated by what you say about the, because it seems like maybe tell me if I'm mischaracterizing this. You're kind of suggesting that endings are sort of have a little bit of the cold inevitability.
Yeah, totally.
About them.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they can't respond to what a character wants or feels like they need or is afraid of. It's kind of an indifference, or I don't know how to.
What do you mean by difference?
Oh, indifference. Oh. I'm thinking of naturalism. What is it called? Not naturalism, but determinism. The kind of.
Do you mean, Chris, that the ending should arrive in a way that is indifferent to the emotional needs of the character?
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking of actually To Build a Fire and the idea of nature and kind of like, even though not all the stories in this book are about man's man trying to survive difficult natural conditions, you know, out in nature, they're trying to survive life, and the kind of, you know, what's the other classic one, open boat, you know, but this idea that like actually all of your wants and needs are kind of they don't have any, you don't have as much control over like what's going to happen. And so even though not all these stories take place in that setting, you know, maybe I'm trying to draw too neat of a line, but it's very interesting for me to hear that you, because I had never really thought of endings that way before, where you have
inevitability of them.
Inevitability, the kind of, I'm trying to avoid too strong language, but the kind of cold inevitability of where these stories end. And that maybe mirrors a little bit of the power of nature, and you're lucky to make it to the cabin. And maybe you make it to the cabin, maybe you don't. But it's whether you do or not is not really up to you. You can try, but maybe you don't.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think that I have a tendency for I don't know about darker, but I have a tendency for sometimes ambiguous or not too neatly wrapped up, but also not happy endings. The happiest story in that whole collection is about the guy that dies, and then he gets reunited with his wife and daughter in the next world over. So,
Anniversary.
Yeah. So my stories are not.
Well, the one story wasn't.
Are you thinking of Let Your Breathing Return to Normal? The one where his girlfriend leaves him, and then it turns out that he wanted his girlfriend's friend all along.
Yeah. I really liked that one. That was probably my favorite story in the whole collection.
Yeah, I was thinking about that one a bit because I was, you know, at the time that you mentioned, Daryl, the need for the ending to seem both surprising and inevitable, right? Mm-hmm. And that ending, for people who haven't read the collection, basically what happens is the protagonist's girlfriend leaves him. He goes out, gets drunk, falls down a hill, and finds himself calling his now ex-girlfriend's good friend that he slept with a couple years before, give or take, and, you know, comes back to her apartment and realizes there's sort of this revelatory moment that maybe all along they actually had the better connection. And I think that the progression of that, right, where like there's this kind of peripheral element that becomes the resolving thing, that seems like it illustrates very, very well the principle that you were talking about, Daryl, of the surprise and the inevitability together, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I went back and forth about to what extent it has such a neat inevitability that it almost kind of sidelines the question of is this happy or not, right? It's a change. It has a resolving quality, but it's going to be years before either of these characters know if it does represent a happy ending.
Yeah. I think those are real. I think the simplistic emotional terms are really dangerous for a writer. Like happy, sure. Happy, sad. I think for a good story, I think there needs to be some almost contradictory texturing of human emotions in some ways. So if what you got by the end was that it wasn't entirely happy, I think that's good in all of these stories.
I really want to talk about, too, the story in the context of endings. I don't know that I can form a question about it, but I really am. I keep coming back to really wanting to talk about the story Skinning Wolverines, right? Because what you do there structurally is that the ending is actually a presentation of this kind of central scene that we've been dancing around all along, right? It reminded me almost a bit of, it's been years since I read it, but it reminded me a bit of my recollection of Chronicle of a Death Foretold, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, where there's this central event. And then there's the central event that happens in this very cold, neutral way right at the end of the story, even though chronologically it's happened at the beginning. And you have this series of kind of scenes of either the setup to it or people dancing around it, and more and more and more of the picture around it is filled in. But you don't get that core thing until the end, right? And that, again, that sense of inevitability, of cold inevitability, kind of comes into it, except in this case it's almost like the cold inevitability of memory or history.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought that story up, because I was thinking about it with some of the things we were talking about earlier. I mean, this is a way to think about the emotions of a story. That is not a story about a guy that dies out on a lake. It's a story about a guy who's grappling with his conscience. I mean, that's what the story's about. When I originally sent that story out, I got a note back from an editor saying that the ending was, that I needed to change the ending, that it was too harsh. And then what I realized in revision, the revision I made was not to change the ending, but to change the beginning so that the ending made more sense. And the change that I made was to have the character, what I just said, grapple with his conscience. So in the first, I think it's the first paragraph or early in that story, he's talking about him as a man of action by taking this inaction was kind of the most a bad thing that he's done. And so the rest of the story is explaining what it is about his conscience that he's grappling with, and what is the backstory that he comes to. So then when we get to the ending and the character, the harsh thing happens, you know, we realize that the story's about, is not really about that all along so much as this guy kind of grappling with his own conscience and also his relationship and his wife and what she now thinks about him and how they're going to deal with that. So a lot of that is subtext. It's subtle in the story or only mentioned once or something, but that ties back to what we were talking about with endings, how the ending needs to kind of be tied to something in the beginning or middle, you know, to make sense sometimes. So that was some of the best advice I ever got from an editor, was to fix the ending. And I didn't do anything to change the ending, but I fixed the story and, you know, to make the ending make more sense. So I'm also struck by how many times what editors, the best advice editors give end up being just a new way to think about your story to fix it. And often the advice itself is not the right advice, but it leads you to the right advice. And that's what happened with that, with that story.
Interesting.
That's my favorite. I mean, I loved all these stories.
Thank you.
And I'm not saying that to blow smoke up your ass.
That's all right. That's really all right too. If you are, that's fine.
Hey, everyone's into something, right?
I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah. But I really loved Skinning Werewolves. Wolverines. Let's call it Werewolves.
Skinning Werewolves is a really good idea.
Stephanie,
yeah, that's
Stephanie
a good one too.
Meyer,
I would like
and
that.
And Daryl Farmer get together and write a short story, right?
Yeah, I would love to write that story.
I kind of a cheeky question. Were you thinking of anyone when you wrote about Gary?
can I ask you why? That's fascinating to me that you answered that question. That you asked that question. The answer is yes. So, but I'm fascinated what it was that gave me away.
I have a related question that might shed some light on that. Are there just as a general craft question, are there characters you write that you are thinking about people and characters you write that you aren't thinking about people? Or are you always thinking about someone or a few people when you write a character?
There's a range. Where we land is entirely made up. I mean, I've never even played football. That character is entirely not based on anybody I know, but I would, and then the character that Chris just asked about is actually based on a situation when I was teaching out in the village in Alaska, and there's definitely that character Gary is based on somebody specific. So there's a whole range of that. I would say for the generally characters are an amalgamation of people I know and fictional elements, and sometimes more than one person. You know, it's just a matter of throwing a lot of things in the blender and seeing kind of what comes out of it. But that's kind of interesting that you picked up on that story and that character, because he is real. He's very much alive, and he's still in Alaska somewhere, I presume. He didn't die out on the lake, but he's
you wouldn't tell us if he had, and
if we just kind of left in there. No, I Matt, probably wouldn't. You probably wouldn't be talking to me.
I would think that if a real life situation, you know, and a guy ended up dead on the ice, and you publish a story about it years later, that could get you into trouble, probably.
The first story in the collection, Yukon, that has to do with a murder, and that really happened. That was based on something that really happened in the town that I lived in. It's heavily fictionalized. I feel like that equation is just kind of putting things in a blender and seeing what comes out of it. And often a mix of real life experiences and things you've read about and things you've heard about and stories, and then things you make up, and all of those kind of feeds into the stories, and then there's some kind of range. Maybe if you think about putting ingredients in a blender, and truth is one ingredient, and what we call fiction is another ingredient, and then some stories have higher concentrations of one than the other. You know, but there's always some kind of balance between those two things. I think even people that write speculative things, you know, there are often parallels to their real lives.
I just want to say, like, the thing in Skinny Wolverines, because of its structure and because of, as short stories, these are all sort of like built up of parts where each part is essential. But like, for me, like, the things that sometimes really make a story, or where somewhere along the way, like, there is just sort of like this, not deviation, but there's like a shape or something done that makes the whole thing work. Mm-hmm. In a way that, like, and I really want to, page 105, if I could read this part, and it's the part where, again, we jump forward to after he's allowed Gary to die, and he's, mm-hmm. he's having the argument with his wife, Stephanie. And that makes this story for me. Like, I love this. I just, the whole part just was so rich. And where he starts from their argument, it was the worst fight we ever had, and I didn't understand until later that what I was fighting for was for her to stay by me. And what she was fighting for was a reason not to leave, that what we were both fighting for was love, the only battle ever truly worth fighting. And then I expected to sleep as in the guest bed, but she held on to me and cried. And it was then that I understood that understood love is greater than sin, not so much that it carries more weight as on a balancing scale, but that it is like the boundless ocean, soft waves smothering and smoothing stone, relentlessly molding the hardness away. And like, the rest of this is really good. I won't read all of it, but like, that whole section is amazing. But like, that somehow, like, that flourish just blows the story away for me. Like, and I just wanted to tell you, thank love you. That story.
Thank you. That sounded great to me hearing you read that.
who wrote that? That was good.
Yeah, is there an audiobook of this yet? Maybe you can get Chris to do it.
That's the exact thing I was talking about. That's really what the story is about, is not so much their relationship, although that's part of it, but it's just him grappling with what he's done, or in this case, what he's not done.
One question that I had that was kind of on this truth versus fiction topic. So, Glass Fragments on the Shoulder of Highway 375, I found really interesting. It was another story that I really, really enjoyed, because it had kind of this essayistic nature where, you know, you're talking about Freud and, you know, and so I thought, you know, I enjoyed that story. And I kept thinking that there was something that you said at a reading that you gave shortly after coming up to Fairbanks. And I swear you said something like you were working on another book that was somewhere between fiction and nonfiction. Like, there were parts that were literally nonfiction, and then you were weaving. You were weaving fiction into it, and this story wanted me to ask: was this story, you know, one of these stories that you were working on or thinking about, or something along those lines?
Yeah, yeah, I know exactly what you were talking about. It was in the fall of 2010. I actually read this story.
This is the one you read?
I read it. Yeah, I read it at the Midnight Sun reading the first year I was there.
Right. Okay.
And it's a collage story, right?
Right.
And I remember talking about it afterwards. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I remember Hans, I remember you read something similar at the student reading.
Well, kind of. I mean, the my sense of this story, like, it's funny, Patrick, that you asked that question, because that's almost exactly the question that I was waiting to ask when there was a good segue that I mentioned before, right? So you've right. been redeemed again. But
right. Yeah.
But I mean, the sense that I had of reading the story was there's almost, I don't want to say a meta quality to it, right? But it feels like a collage essay written by a fictional character, right?
Right.
Not so much that you've taken your nonfiction and your fiction writing and jumbled them, as that this fictional character has created this essay, if that distinction makes sense, right? I suppose to some extent it's kind of an arbitrary difference, right? But I found it very interesting to think about. I mean, to one extent or another, a lot of fictional writing is presented as the book that you're reading is an artifact created by the character, right? And because I know your background as a nonfiction professor, like, this feels like an essay that would be in one of the nonfiction anthologies that you had me read in Forms of Nonfiction, except that instead of being written by a real person and presented as an essay, it's written as a fictional person. It's written by a fictional person, but that fictional person's, like, writing for his Forms of Nonfiction class, you know?
Yeah, I feel like it's even complicated further by the... I feel like not only in the text itself, but in the narrative voice itself, because I don't think it's entirely a fictional narrator. I think it's partly a fictional narrator and partly me, because some of the elements of that story are actually nonfiction. And then I don't know if I should say this, so let me quantify it after I say it, but I love this story so much. I don't care if you love it. And I really don't care if it's good. It's not that so much that just the process of it was such a different process. When if you think about narrative, generally narrative is causation. One thing leads to another, you know, along the narrative arc, or else it's Odysseus travel narrative where one new event happens after another. So there's kind of a sequence in either one of those kind of traditional tales. But with this story, the connective tissue was resonance between sections, you know, instead of kind of a narrative bridge. It's just trying to put the pieces together. And so it was literally like putting a puzzle together. It was just cutting a lot of random writings that I had done over the years and trying to find an order to put them in that made some kind of logical sense, but not in a traditional logical way so much as a resonant way between the pieces. And then the challenge was to kind of build some kind of narrative in between those, you know, where it's about a character who has, if I remember this story right, a character who's cheated on his wife, and then that's kind of that narrative about that and what happened is kind of the connective tissue that runs through it. So that story is unlike anything else, but some of those sections are pulled directly out of nonfiction pieces that I had written at various times. And some of it was pulled from fictional pieces, and then it was just kind of putting together. So it's the most hybrid thing I've ever done. I don't know if that answered or even got at what your question was. I think your question was about truth and, you know, fiction and nonfiction and kind of the merging of that.
Well, I was going to bring in a craft aspect of it too, right? Like, as somebody who most of my experience with you as a professional has been as a nonfiction writer and how those two processes related to each other, but you kind of answered that without my having to ask it. So
cool. That's a fun story to write. It feels like the kind of story that you know you can get away with once. It doesn't feel like a process you can overuse, you know. Flannery right. O'Connor said that a writer can writers can try to get away with anything, but in her experience, you can't really get away with much. I feel like I got away with something with this story.
Hmm. Interesting.
Do you have any other examples of things that you got away with in this collection?
No, not really. The only other kind of experimental thing is this story that's 6 pages and it's one sentence long.
Right.
You know, maybe.
What was your thinking behind using that form? That was something that it in retrospect, when I think about it, it makes kind of sense because, you know, adds a bit of a dreamy stream of consciousness, blurred feeling.
Yeah,
which,
that's it exactly.
Yep. Yeah, which you know, seems relevant given that it's a story about a guy dying and being reunited with his loved ones after death. So.
Well, I think that's it. I think the long sentences are really good for stream of consciousness, for dreams.
Right.
You know, for kind of getting towards a subconscious level. It's a blatant ripoff of a Gabriel Garcia Marquez story, which is called The Ghost of the Shipwrecked Sailor. No, that's not. That's his book. It's about the ghost ship. And it's the same thing. It's a 6-page story that's one sentence long. You know, and the trick becomes trying to not overuse conjunctions and still kind of
right.
have a sentence that flows and makes sense and doesn't and has enough forward momentum that it doesn't lose the reader. But again, that's another one that I feel like is a one time. I mean, you don't want to read a collection of those.
Hopefully this question isn't off track, but I feel like it's related. You're a Cormac McCarthy fan, right?
Yeah.
And he uses conjunctions very frequently in his work, you know, and the character I know that's a divisive figurative language, but I forget what it's called, an oratory device. But do you feel like he gets away with it? And if he gets away with it, why can't you get away with it?
I think he gets away with it and he writes long sentences, but not 6 pages.
Well, that's true.
So that's the
true.
Difference, but it's also the, you know, Cormac McCarthy often uses the language of the Bible, and that use of the word
right.
and is very kind of biblical. So
right.
It gives it, so his language, often his language will feel theological. And then if you go back and look at it, logically, there's nothing really theological about it at all.
Mm.
You know, but it, other than that, it's kind of a language that
I've always thought of his style as like a mythic type style, like you know, everything whenever he's writing, he's achieving some kind of mythopoetic status with his writing. But that's kind of veering off too far, probably. But interesting.
Yeah, he's definitely worth studying. I do. Sometimes those writers that are so distinct, you can tell. Like I can tell sometimes when what students have been reading by what they write.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And he's one of those writers that even people I know that are literary scholars that study his work will say that they find themselves writing their scholarly papers about him and the kind of sense syntax using
right.
just kind of has a way of seeping in when you read it.
Yeah, it really does. I have to catch.
Sorry.
What's that?
I was going to say, what's the writer that you you read students' work and you're like, oh, fuck. They're reading a lot of DeLillo. or what's the one that you're the most like, oh, crap. You know, like you like the writer, but.
Yeah, Kurt Vonnegut. I think that happens. And sometimes I've had that happen with Camus. I think some of those writers that are really kind of that have such a distinct voice, that's immediately, if you read a sentence, you immediately know they wrote it. And then when students start being influenced by or emulating them, I kind of know right away what they've been reading.
Yeah. Vonnegut's got such a weird, like, it's this, his novels have this weird flighty surface quality, like not in a bad way. It's just like, I feel like when you read a Vonnegut novel, it's never about the characters. Does that make any sense?
The characters are almost like cartoon characters.
Exactly.
He does the exact thing you're not supposed to do as a narrator, which is that the narrative voice is like heavily present on the page.
Right.
Yeah.
There's
interiority, but it's always very short, very brief, very encapsulated. There's never much of a dip in the interiority. It's just kind of, here's enough to move us forward.
Yeah. Right. The puppeteer is very.
Yeah.
He's behind the screen.
He's clearly, and he's aware that the puppeteer is visible, and like he's trying to say something by the fact that the puppeteer is visible, though I'm not quite sure what in some respects, but
there's a kind of absurdity to that he's playing on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
He's definitely worth reading. He's a writer that there's a lot of writers like this, maybe, that he's definitely worth reading but not emulating.
Yeah.
Because it becomes so obvious right away, you know, that where the work comes from.
Well, anyway, you want to develop your own style anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to learn from your favorite writers, but even your favorite writers, having them as an influence is good, but emulating is not so good.
Yeah. Well, people start emulating. Like, you just,
you emulate, right. And then you get better out. And develop. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Unless you're like me, and then I end up writing like whoever I'm reading.
Mm.
In the moment, like it, and it's hard to escape the gravity of really like a really compelling voice. And I find myself like, oh my gosh, like if I'm reading like a noir, I'm trying to think of the writer,
Chandler?
Classic noir writer. No, one of the earlier ones.
What was his name? I totally forget.
I think he wrote The Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, what was that?
I can't remember his
name.
Dash it. What is it?
Yeah.
Dashiell Hammett,
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have all the right letters. I'm not sure of the order.
Yeah, we're wrong.
We should know who this is.
Yeah, but it's like, I just want to write. I'll be like, oh my gosh, I want to write a book like this. And then I start writing it, and then,
That can be a problem for me. It's point of view.
If
I start writing something in first person, and then I pick up something and read it, and it's third person, I'm like, oh, I have to write this in third person. I'm not that way so much anymore, but when I started writing, I had to be I learned that I had to be really careful what I was reading while I was writing specific projects.
Sure.
I had one last question.
I have one last question too. So go ahead, Chris.
It's about short versus longer stories, and kind of it's about like a little bit about like your experience writing. Like, how do you know when a story is going to be shorter? How do you know when it's going to keep going? And then, like, do you think that they kind of perform different functions? Like, you know, maybe they. Well, that's basically the question.
The first question is kind of hard to tell. It just without sounding glib or I just kind of know it has to do a little bit with the pacing. I'm thinking of like Skinny Wolverines. Like, I knew that was going to be a 20-some page story. Excuse me. Right when I started writing it, and some of those so-called flash pieces in that book, I think the thing that distinguishes them is just a kind of specific moment in time. As opposed to kind of a sequence of events. So in that sense, I think they're very different in terms of design. What was the second half of that question?
Well, first I'll comment, like, one of the things that I felt was really clear was in those shorter pieces in this collection. White Collar, Flight, Hurdles. It felt like the sentences were interlaced in terms of like one moment being actually spread across like a whole bunch of different things. Flight, individual sentences, maybe not so much, but a paragraph will be doing a lot and kind of pulling in a lot of different things. And it feels like a moment that is sort of a node for a bunch of different other moments. That was something that was, if I didn't know, and I don't know if I did know with some of these stories, I was like, oh, this is going to be shorter. I think by the time I got to Flight, I was like, oh, wow, there's all this kind of being pulled into this moment, and it's like, I'm going to turn the page and that'll be the end of the story. And it was something somehow like you communicated that to me. And so,
that's interesting to me. I'd have to go back and look. I feel like those stories probably have a lot of interiority. White Collar is actually it's a little bit more than a moment, it's kind of the moment between when the men, the IRS or whoever the police, whoever they are, come and talk to him the first time to when they come and pick him up at the end. So there's a little bit more of a longer narrative there. But the other one, the guy's just flying. He's just in an airplane flying over what he presumes is his ex's house. So there's just that brief moment. And that seems more kind of in line with generally how I think about Flash, is that kind of singular moment that's maybe seconds, but with time kind of becomes expanded for the character.
I think that answers my second part of that question anyway, which is just how they function differently.
And my final question is somewhat related, because it's specifically about the short story Hurdles, which to me felt like somewhat of a puzzle box in this collection. You mentioned like Flight. It's brief. It's just a moment. He's passing over his ex. But it made sense to me because relationships and breaking up and trying to heal fractures between people is very prevalent in this collection. Whereas Hurdles deals with a character demographic that really isn't represented in any of the other stories. It's a frat boy in a college who, is very straightforward with women and gets rejected all the time. And it's almost a moment, but it's not as brief of a moment as Flight, but it's shorter than White Collar. It starts out as a party and then kind of ends up like a couple hours later, correct me if I'm wrong, where that he's on, right. Where he's on the track running around, and the story ends with him doing these laps. So it's also related to this question of Flash versus non-Flash fiction, long versus short, and it's related to this earlier discussion we had about endings. How does that function? What do you think its place in the collection is? And, why are we dealing with a younger character as opposed to mostly dealing with older characters and older in ranging from my age, which is 38, to, like 85 or something? And why does the story end where it does? I don't know. The whole story is interesting but opaque to me. that's legitimate to ask that, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I can talk about that story and maybe I'll get to your to an answer in here somewhere. That
right.
Part of my reason for loving astronomy and stars so much, I bring this up because that's how the story ends.
Right.
Is it's a constant reminder of how I don't want to say insignificant. I don't think human lives are insignificant, but it is a constant reminder, and I think we seek solace in the stars for that sense that it reminds us that we're part of a larger collection of galaxies that we know nothing about, and it does make our lives seem small in some way, mm-hmm. some ways. And so that's a little bit about what that story's about, is everything that this guy's going through. It just seems so kind of important to him in those moments, you know, because he's so kind of myopically focused on his own life, as most of us are to some degree.
When in reality, being a loser in college isn't that big of a deal.
Yeah, well, it ended up not being such a big deal, because that story is very much, it's definitely fiction, but it's also definitely me.
when I was in college,
from the party to being out in the snow running around, that whole night is very vivid in my
I've been vindicated on this podcast, and I come out totally insulting the guest.
I don't feel insulted at all. You kind of nailed who I was then at that moment. Actually, you're totally vindicated in that. Yeah.
That's interesting, though. That's interesting. You know, we definitely are. People are myopic about their own lives. I know I am. I'm definitely sure Hans and Chris are.
Do you sound more sure about us than about yourself?
It was just being a jerk to try to get a laugh. That's all.
Try to get a rise.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how much to say about that. I'm often shocked by how little I knew. I don't want to use the word stupid. I'm often kind of amazed when I look back at who I was when I was in college, undergrad.
Oh yeah.
Relative to who I became, I don't really understand how that guy got here. Yeah. It's one of the most inspirational stories you can ever imagine. I just like that guy was just such an idiot.
Sure.
Yeah.
He wasn't a screw up. He just didn't know anything about the world. You know?
I think you just did opposite of a humble brag.
What did I just do?
I don't know what it was. You did the opposite of a humble brag. I'm not sure what I would call it, but it was like almost the antithesis. I don't know. It's like you were basically saying, I don't know how to convey how much I am now versus how terrible I was. Right.
Yeah. It's
I love it.
You were about to say something, Hans?
I was. I kind of lost the thread of it, though. It's fine.
Oh, I'm sorry, man.
No. It's fine.
In any case, it looks like, we've kind of, the discussion's wound down. Any last questions or comments from any of you?
No, I mean, I really enjoyed the collection, and I really appreciate that you gave us the chance to talk to you about it.
Me too, you guys. I can't tell you enough how much I appreciate having the opportunity to talk about it and just to interact with you guys. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate that.
I'd like
how
to
long have you been doing this?
It's lovely.
This podcast.
Over a year now, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we started.
I think
I started it last year, and then after a couple of episodes, you know, I had one of my buddies was on, but then he had to bow out, and then so it became pretty regular. Hans and Chris around. I'm gonna say
I think
a year
so.
Ago.
Yeah, I was just looking through my files here. I think the first one we did was DeLillo, and I can't find that file. But we did, you and I, Patrick, did Jude the Obscure. I think that's the first one that we did after DeLillo, and that was kind of the first one where we started to settle more into the format.
Right.
And that was November 2018.
Right. Oh, okay. So that was, it's been even that long ago. Okay, yeah. So we've been doing it a while.
Cool. And how long does it take you to edit, and how long does it take to finish one show?
Not like it really doesn't take that long. The editing process
usually adding the sound effects is usually the most time consuming part.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You got to keep your hands ready on the boing-oing-oing.
Yeah, and the farts and the sirens. Like, you know, we're going to make such a fool out of you, Daryl. Like, you are going to you're gonna regret this the rest of your
can't.
Life.
Yeah, I can't. I can't wait.
I don't know how to tell you how much of an idiot I was in college. Boing-oing-oing.
That's so perfect.
That is perfect.
Anything you can do to make me sound less intelligent than I actually am is a real tribute to your skills here, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was like another one of these like high brags about himself. That's awesome. But I Daryl, really. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Chris.
I say I loved it.
Oh, thanks.
I really loved
it. Thanks so much. I really, this really means a lot to me.
And I just wanted to thank you also, Daryl. Thank you for coming on. I also really enjoyed the story collection. You know, I pointed out several stories that I thought were awesome. And it's, you know, I remember reading Bicycling Beyond the Divide and really liking that as well. And I still have your autographed copy here in my office. So, publish another book right away so we can have you back on.
All right, man. I'm working on it.
All right. Excellent.
You too. The three of you also.
Well, yeah. I'm working on a novel right now. I can't speak for the other two, but I hope to.
We're
have,
too myopically focused on ourselves, Patrick.
Yeah, you guys need to focus on yourselves.
Yeah, we need. We can't stop.
You don't have time.
I don't have time not to focus on myself.
Yeah, like in this time of COVID, you should be belting things out.
Yeah,
I'm.
Yeah, I should.
Yeah, I mean, I'm making huge progress on my novel. I'm almost done with part two, and then I'll have part three done and the whole thing done here in a few months. Probably more like 12 months. It'll probably take me another year to finish it.
That's fantastic.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to getting rejected a bunch of times.
I want to make a suggestion that Hans, you should start addressing the internet with this. I'm not sure exactly what role you'd perform, but sort of like anonymous or some kind of like anti-establishment, like ranting. You could disguise your voice and then gesticulate over the camera, because I feel like
Hans is doing this.
There's something about like watching Hans's hands reach, because you're very emotive, Hans, and you gesticulate like this, and somehow it conveys personality and presence without actually showing your voice, after showing your face. And I've never seen this done before as like a technique for communicating like emotionally without actually showing your face, but somehow it works. It's really weird.
It's very shamanic and mystical.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if I do that, I'll probably have to buy a cover for my light fixture, but
yeah,
I think that's part of it.
I don't know. The light's part of the mystique.
Yeah.
In any case, Daryl, really, thank you for coming on. And yeah, before I say goodbye, listeners, Chris, did you have a pick for next time, or are you still thinking?
Oh, is it my turn?
Yeah, I think so. This was my pick. I picked Where We Land by Daryl Farmer.
Because you jumped, I jumped the queue last time. So
that's right. Okay, Daryl, do you have something that you've read recently that you think that we should read?
You know what? I've been reading a lot of Icelandic literature, and there's this author I like a lot. His name is John Kalman Stefansson.
Sweet.
And he has a book called. It's the first of a trilogy. It's called Heaven and Hell.
Heaven and Hell.
I really love that book. Yeah, I really love that book.
All right.
Does that sound good to you guys?
I'll read it.
But I don't have a whole lot of information to go on, but I'd be
I'd be sorry, Hans,
if I said no.
Daryl has spoken.
I mean, it's your choice, Chris, so if that's what you want to pick, that's fine. I'll read it. I'll read whatever.
Check it out. My tastes are not everybody's taste. I would go online and see if it looks interesting to me. It's beautifully, I don't know what to tell you. It's beautifully lyrical. It's about a boy, young boy, dealing with grief and traveling across Iceland and finding a community where he can connect in. It's a pretty, I think
That
it's
sounds
pretty good book.
That
sounds
interesting.
Like a bunch of bullshit.
Community.
Yeah, it sounds pretty myopic and self-obsessed.
Lyrical.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
who needs community? Yeah. We got a social distance right now.
Yeah. I really wanted another novel about a man being forced in a trance-like state to have sex with underage women.
I will say because this does bring, because it sounds like the boy is obsessed with Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost is another one of the ones that I did want to do,
like the actual Milton.
Could
poem?
We do? Should we do them together?
Yeah, we could do them together.
Pair them up.
So we're gonna
Daryl,
do.
You've read it. Would that inform this book at all? Because it's.
I'm sure that it would, yeah. Paradise Lost comes up, but I don't know that they're thematically linked, other than the book is an important book for the boy to read.
Let's do it.
But yeah, so, you could definitely link them together. That would be.
So we're going to talk about Milton's Paradise Lost, which I have read, mind you, and John Keller Stephenson's Heaven and Hell.
Kalman Stephenson.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, John Kalman Stephenson, yeah.
All right, sounds good to me. I'm on it. Okay, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this special episode with our guest, Daryl Farmer, author of Where We Land and distinguished faculty member at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Peace out until next time, everyone.